You are listening to a PERC podcast brought to you by the Property and Environment Research Center. This episode features PERC President Terry Anderson discussing the right to own property on American Indian reservations. What initially got you interested in American Indian economies?
I first got interested in American Indian reservation economies when I visited a member of the Salish Kootenai Confederated Tribes on the Flathead Reservation. I took some Swiss people there to meet him and his wife and tried to explain to them what they could expect on a reservation. We arrived and it was nothing like that. Instead, it was a beautiful home with lush grass, cattle grazing, a wonderful library in the living room, and it seemed like quite a contrast with what I had described. The member of the tribe then, in response to my question of how he explained the difference, said, "I own this place." That got my curiosity up as a property rights economist. How much did ownership matter to how well Indian reservation economies performed? And that really got me off on the track of studying this. But it even goes before that, that my uncle managed on the Blackfeet Reservation in north central Montana. And there I had a wonderful hero, Francis Calflooking. He was the cowboy who taught me how to ride. And I remember thinking that he seemed so much like me, and yet today American Indians are set apart and away from the rest of the population. And again, that just fosters my interest in why are they so different economically than the rest of the country.
And what are the major impediments to growth on reservations?
Economists have really only recently turned to explaining why American Indian reservations are islands of poverty and a sea of wealth. And the explanations that have come out are the typical ones used for developing countries. First, it's a lack of resources. Then it's a lack of human resources or human capital, education. Then it's a lack of infrastructure, roads and water and electricity. But most recently, economists who studied the developing world have focused on institutions, property rights, and the rule of law. And I think it's the latter explanation that really explains why Indian reservation economies are poor. If you look at the size of reservations and the resources they have, that can't be the explanation. American Indians have over 2% of the U.S. landmass. 12 of the reservations are the size of Rhode Island. They have tremendous resources, including coal, oil, and even a lot of productive farmland. And yet, the production from those lands is minimal. The Crow Reservation in Montana has billions of dollars worth of coal, and yet they're one of the poorest tribes in the country. It's not a lack of resources. And education certainly is a problem, though that's improving. But my research, especially done with Dean Luke and Nick Parker, two scholars here at PERC, shows that property rights and the rule of law make a difference. The main reason that these lands and resources are not more productive, I think, is the structure of bureaucracy that governs them. These lands are held in trust by the federal government. That means that the Bureau of Indian Affairs must determine when and how the lands can be put to productive use. This gives a whole layer of bureaucratic red tape that Indians must get through. If land is going to be put into productive use for agriculture, it must be approved by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It's often owned by multiple heirs. Sometimes even 1,000 or more people can own 160 acres. I think of it as imagine getting together with your favorite cousins, aunts, uncles, and brothers and sisters to make decisions about whether you plant corn or wheat. And then finally, these lands, because they're held in trust, cannot be used as collateral in loans for loans from banks. That means that the most important asset that Indians have, their lands, are essentially locked up when it comes to borrowing money, which is an important part of any agricultural activity.
Is there a history of institutions that leads you to think that American Indians and First Nations can live in a capitalist system?
When I first got interested in studying American Indians, I couldn't help but look at the rich institutional history that exists prior to contact with Europeans. American Indians fully understood the importance of, as we put it at PERC, getting the incentives right. For example, in buffalo hunting, the people who rode their privately owned horses into the buffalo herd and shot a buffalo were rewarded with the best cuts of meat. That meant that good archers, good horsemen, got higher pay, if you will, than other people who didn't participate with such skills. That's just one example of many in the context of American Indian history that suggests that when faced with the right incentives, they understood how to make the institutions work. Some tribes had privately owned land. Some tribes in the Pacific Northwest owned beaches that became what were called clam gardens. They developed these, they invested in these, and I think this rich institutional history suggests that the same could be true today if American Indians could be freed from the top-down approach that saddled them with constraints from the federal government that I think almost hold them in bondage and make it much more difficult for them to earn income and wealth from their resource base.
How does studying American Indian property rights relate to PERC?
PERC's mission is to improve environmental quality using property rights and markets. American Indian reservations are a classic case of a huge resource base that could be more productive for the Indians themselves in terms of generating income, but can also be a tremendous environmental asset for the tribes themselves as well as people surrounding them. The Flathead Indian Reservation in Montana, for example, produces timber that generates jobs and incomes, but at the same time, its timberlands are habitat for endangered species such as grizzly bears, as well as numerous other species, elk, deer, birds. And the water coming off that reservation is of high quality, which means there's an ecosystem service provided by that reservation. PERC has a very large research project underway now to study just how American Indians might benefit from the ecosystem services that they provide for other people. We're developing a handbook on resource use that will help Indian leaders better understand how they can manage their coal, their timber, their water, their wildlife, all with an eye toward improving the lot of American Indians while also improving environmental quality. That's what PERC is all about, and we think that property rights are a key to making this work better on American Indian reservations. The institutions that govern American Indian lands and the resources thereon have been in place for a long time, starting back in the 1870s with the Dawes Act. The Congress put these lands essentially into a trust status that has locked them up ever since. Trying to break down that bureaucracy is a very, very difficult process. There is some good news to the north. In Canada, a proposal is likely to go before Parliament this fall that will allow individual bands to determine whether they would like to have private property ownership on their reserves. Because of the research that PERC has done over the last 20 years on property rights generally and Indian economies more particularly, Manny Jules, the former chief of the Sechewap Band, and one of his colleagues, André Le Dressé, who now runs an institute at Thompson River University, contacted us, came to PERC, and spent 2 days visiting with us about how property rights interface with tribal and reserve economies. On his reservation, they have some long-term leases, which are effectively allowing lands to be taken out of bureaucratic control from the federal government. The legislation proposed in Canada would expand that. I was in Kamloops, British Columbia, earlier this summer to visit Manny and his reserves. It was impressive to stand on a bluff across the river looking at the reserve and seeing, on the one hand, undeveloped, beautiful riverfront land that could be deriving incredible amounts of wealth and income for the band, and yet it's sitting idle or at best in very low productive uses. But if you looked more carefully, you could see an industrial park that has a 99-year lease where jobs are created for people who are members of the band as well as other citizens of Kamloops, and then a golf course development that's unbelievable. There are homes worth hundreds, if not millions, of dollars, with beautiful lawns and flowers that look like a prosperous community compared to the trailer park next door, which, as Manny put it, is only connected to septic tanks if you consider a buried car a septic tank. This is a poor reservation that expects to grow very wealthy as a result of private ownership. That has led to an interaction between the Institute there and PERC that is developing a course for Thompson River University for band leaders in Canada, helping them better understand how to organize their government, to better understand how property rights fit into the management of their resources, and ultimately to improve the economic well-being of First Nations in Canada. We think that this is going to provide tremendous opportunities for us to take the same lessons south of the border to Indian leaders here in the United States. The Hearth Act, signed by President Obama, is a step in the right direction in that it allows tribes to avoid bureaucratic control in leasing lands for up to 25 years. This differs from the Canadian proposal, which is full private property rights, which doesn't then just mean you can lease for 25 years, it means you can sell the land. The difference will be that a much longer time horizon will be applied to those lands in Canada than will be applied if there's just a 25-year lease. The other big difference, of course, in Canada will be that the lands, even if sold out of First Nation hands, will remain under the jurisdiction of the band governments. Here in the United States, private land on reservation is not under the jurisdiction of tribal governments, with a few minor exceptions, but rather is under state jurisdiction. That means tribes can't tax the land, they can't put land use regulations on it. And that means that if the land, and a lot of it has been transferred to private hands, if it's been transferred, it's not available really to be part of the reservation. And therefore, I think, is very different from Canada. Much of the legislation that governs Indian land in the United States and Canada is very top-down. That is, it comes from the federal government down to the tribes or the bands, and they're told what they can and cannot do. The proposal to change legislation in Canada will be bottom-up. The tribe or the band will take a vote and decide if they want private property rights. If 50% plus one of the population says we want them, they will get them. The federal government cannot impose this on the bands or tell the bands they can't have it. That is a very important step because for too long we have treated American Indians, First Nations in Canada, as if they need to be guided from above when they're fully capable of determining their own lives and well-being.
To find out more about American Indian property rights, visit www.perc.org.